35 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited that we can begin this week of morning shows with a good friend of the program, Dr. Thomas Carr, who is on the biology faculty at Carthage College and director of their paleontology program. And of course, if you listen to the morning show with any regularity, you know that Dr. Thomas Carr has joined us on any number of occasions, sometimes to talk about the dinosaur digs that happen every other summer out in Montana. But on today's program, Dr. Carr is here along with two of his paleontology students at Carthage to talk about the experience that they recently had about a month ago at the 82nd annual meeting of SVP, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, which occurred in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And they were not just attending, but they were actually presenting. All three of them made presentations on various topics related to vertebrate paleontology. And we're going to be talking about each of their presentations, the kind of things that the kind of information that they presented, and sort of the arc of development that it took to get them there. That is, what had to be done in order for them to be even given such an opportunity, and what sort of research are we talking about that ultimately made these presentations as meaningful and significant as they were. So we have lots to talk about. So again, we have, of course, Dr. Thomas Carr with us in the studios, and also with us is Andy Nguyen, who is a junior biology major at Carthage on the paleontology track, and a senior, Nathan Cochran, who is a biology major and a geoscience minor, also on the paleontology track. And both Andy and Nathan have joined us before, along with, of course, Dr. Thomas Carr. So we welcome all three of you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
Greg, it's good to be here.
Glad that you can join us. Thank you so much. So, Dr. Carr, maybe we could begin by having you just describe in general what this this group is, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. I think that will help us then in turn understand the significance of this event, which the three of you participated in.
Yeah, the SVP is the international professional society that sets the standards, practices, and ethics of the science of vertebrate paleontology. And each year it has an annual meeting for participants, members, and their students, scientists and students, to present the results of their latest research. There's also a venue for the technical side of things. Preparators of fossils also have their own session. There's a competitive student session called the Romer Prize session as well. So it's a very intense 5-day gathering of people from all over the world to present the latest and greatest of what's happening in the science.
Hmm. This is something that you attend nearly every year. And how often are you a participant like you were this year?
I think I've only missed two meetings since 1992, when I first attended as an undergrad all by myself. And that meeting was in Toronto. I missed two. I missed Bristol and Mexico City, unfortunately. And so I try to present every time I go. I think I've had a pretty good track record for that. I can't remember from what year, but either a platform presentation or a poster. So there's two types of presentations that can be made. A platform presentation is when you basically give a PowerPoint presentation to a group of 200, 300, 400 people, something like that. Or there's also poster sessions where you print your results on a poster, and you know, during a certain day, you stand next to it for the afternoon to answer people's questions.
So it's kind of like the science fair model, but on a higher level, of course.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So what does it take in order to gain entry as a participant, as a presenter for something like the annual meeting of the SVP?
It's relatively open. So professional scientists, members, and non-members can present. Students can also present. I think whether they're members or not, they have to be sponsored. And generally what happens is an abstract, a summary of a project is submitted, and that is vetted by an anonymous panel of subject area experts, and either there will be an accept or a reject. I've been rejected once. So that process does work. It's not biased, although I don't think my abstract should have been rejected that year.
That's another topic for another day.
There is a formal process, a vetting process, to make sure that everything's on the up and up.
Right. So was it your idea for Nathan and Andy to apply for this opportunity, or did they come to you with this thought?
Well, as part of the paleontology track, it's my objective to have students actually participate in the science in this way. And so the way the paleo track is structured is that in the spring semester of their junior year, they do a deep dive into a specific methodology, and then using that, produce their own original research. So on a topic that is their own, that they own, it's theirs. And they present that at Celebration of Scholars. So that's part of the deal. And also
at Carthage, that's a Carthage event.
Right. That is a Carthage event of a poster session. And part of the deal of that independent study with me is they submit their abstract to SVP as a poster. And basically, 95% of the time, they get accepted. And so that is where Nathan's presentation fits in. Andy's presentation was a little bit different. It wasn't based on the independent study project. That has not happened yet.
But that's right. He's just a junior now. So
yeah.
Right.
And so, like me, he has a concern about the effect of the fossil market on fossil resources. And so Andy put together a fairly interesting talk on the trade in mammoth ivory and the relationship that has to the trade in elephant ivory. So this was sort of an early accelerated part of the process. Andy will eventually give a research-based, quantitative project like Nathan did in a couple of years.
Right. So Andy's presentation or proposal was also found to be fully deserving, and so became part of this meeting.
Yeah. The society is concerned about the market's impact on fossil resources, and so it was a natural fit.
Before we get into the specifics of Nathan's presentation and Andy's, I wanted to ask you about something else that I found intriguing. I want to tell our listeners that Dr. Carr forwarded to me I don't know what you call it. I know it's 377 pages long, so it's very substantial. I was going to say it's the program book,
but
it's certainly not a booklet. It's a full book because there's a lot there in it. Gives descriptions of every single presentation made, and it's hundreds and hundreds that we're talking about. At the front of that, there is this really kind of imposing couple of pages which talks about the code of conduct, and then after that, expected behavior.
Yes.
And you're just kind of reading about this, and it just kind of makes one think about this particular world and some of the topics that are tackled and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Explain to our listeners a little more about this code of conduct and why it is so important to be at the heart of this meeting.
Right. So I think I went over the code of conduct with the students the week before we left. And I actually have a whole laundry list of expected behavior and conduct that may go a bit beyond the SVP code of conduct. But I think this is one of the beneficial upshots of the Me Too movement, where we have to be aware of basically how we interact with other people and to treat others respectfully and professionally and civilly. And, in previous years that hasn't been highlighted perhaps in a way that it should have, but it's a new period now, I think, for our science and all sciences, that we have to be aware of how we treat others and how we interact with them. And so the thrust of it is to promote a mutually beneficial, supportive meeting and interaction with others, that will help advance student participation in the science and our own professional development. Mm.
I also was intrigued by, I think this was under the list of expected behavior and some other, in a sense, regulations that really talked about the whole business of whether or not the presentations of others could be recorded.
Yeah.
Essentially by a complete stranger. We're not talking about Nathan recording Andy's or vice versa, but somebody else from someplace else. And I suppose the concern there is that somebody could, in a sense, cannibalize the research of somebody else and sort of take it into their own. Is that the part of the concern of potential theft of intellectual property?
That may be part of it. I think another part of it is just, with these meetings and the work that's being presented, it's not necessarily completed work. It may be in progress. And so if that gets out, say in the popular media or in the blogosphere or Twitter sphere, the author or the scientist loses control of their own work in that aspect. I think that's part of just keeping control over that. I actually had something happen to myself a number of years ago where a co-author and I had a poster and with a new species of Tyrannosaur, and someone took a picture of the skull on the poster and posted that on the internet. We didn't quite want that out just yet. And I guess part of my fear was that, others could kind of scoop us. They could, if the picture was clear enough, they could code the skull out and run a phylogeny and evolutionary tree and scoop us, so that there's that potentiality as well. Obviously that's assuming the worst of human behavior, but sometimes we have to try and get ahead of that if we can. And so these standards are in place.
Sure. And it just underscores, the reason I'm even bringing it up is it really underscores, in a sense, the seriousness of this event, the seriousness of the work that's being done and the care that's being taken to properly treat these presentations and the information they contain.
Yeah. As part of it is, I do tell my students that, it's a cage match out there. Like, science is competitive, and sometimes irrationally so. And so these guidelines are there in place to try and put a leash on that sort of behavior.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show, first of all, with Dr. Thomas Carr, who heads the paleontology program at Carthage College. And I'm so glad that we have two of his students with him, and we're going to hear from them now. Nathan Cochran, who is a senior, Andy Wynn, who is a junior, both biology majors at Carthage and both part of the paleontology program. And they, along with Dr. Thomas Carr, made presentations about a month ago at the 82nd annual meeting of the SVP, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, that took place in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Nathan, I want to begin with you and the presentation that you made, and it's one of those it's humbling to read a description and realize that you understand about half of the words. But I do get at least kind of the gist of it. Your presentation has something to do with ontogeny, O-N-T-O-G-E-N-Y. Explain what that term is about, and then we'll dig a little further.
Right. So ontogeny is the study of how an animal grows and matures as you move along its lifespan. So essentially, what I did was I was able to identify characters that vary with as an animal grows, and I was able to plot it out on a cladistically using the same methods that we use to recover evolutionary trees. And through that, we're able to gauge the maturity of each specimen or each fossil relative to each other. And that can tell us a lot about how an animal grows or changes, even when we're not seeing it grow in real time, obviously, as they've been doing that.
Because it's millions of years later.
Yeah.
Dr. Carr, explain kind of the origins of this particular assignment or undertaking or project for Nathan, and in a sense, what was the collaboration which gave him the focus to look at this particular thing?
I think it was a few years ago Nathan and I met, and we discussed sort of the overall track and the expectations for the MPEN study. This is sort of the capstone experience of the track itself. And so we were trying to arrive at an animal that has a good sample size, which means a lot of fossils that are relatively complete, that include a good portion of the growth series, so juveniles, subadults, and adults, and also an animal that's in part of the tree of life that is important in terms of sort of big picture stuff. And so we quickly arrived at Dimetrodon, which is a very early mammal relative, and in some ways it's a lot like a standard reptile. You know, it sprawls and, you know, its arms and legs are out to the side. But then it has features in its skull and teeth that look more like modern mammals. And so, you know, it's sort of a snapshot between the typical reptile and what's more mammal-like. Mm-hmm. And so we can think of it as sort of a transitional animal. And so if we can get the growth of that, we can get some insights into not only its growth, but also the evolution of growth itself in that part of the tree. If we later add animals less advanced and more advanced than Dimetrodon, which Nathan has done in his senior thesis.
Very good. So when you were looking at specimens, what exactly were you looking at? And then what kinds of things very specifically were you charting?
So I made multiple trips to the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago to their fossil mammal collections, where I had previously looked at the literature on Dimetrodon to try and identify, okay, what have people seen as ontogenically variable or variable through growth, or just variation in general. So luckily there was a very good previous literature on Dimetrodon growth. Specifically, I was looking mostly at the ossification or moving from cartilage to bone of a lot of the muscle attachment sites on the humerus and femur, which are the upper arm bone and the lower leg bone for Dimetrodon. And of course, they'd been previously investigated by Donald Brinkman and Robert Bakker. The former I was able to actually meet at the meeting, which was lovely. But it's a lot of just, okay, is this big chunk on this humerus? Yes, that's a 1. Is it not? Okay, that's a 0. And then it's just going through my spreadsheet and checking for each feature. I was lucky enough to have a wide collection of Dimetrodon remains, most of which come originally from the University of Chicago's paleontology collection. That were donated in, I believe, the late 1950s to the Field Museum. And I was able to look at a wide variety of completeness and parts from just a piece of an upper jaw to my favorite part was where I was able to get inside the case that was on display in the fossil hall and actually able to measure the skull out of the big mounted Dimetrodon in the back of the Permian hall case. But yeah, that was where most of my data came from.
So I guess what you're doing is, let's say if you're looking at you're looking at the same thing in different specimens and charting, well, this part grows this quickly, this part doesn't grow as quickly. Is that part of what we're talking about?
Not quite. It's not so much the rate of growth as is plotting out the sequence of the growth. So what feature appears first, what feature appears last, what appears in between. So a lot of what I found was that the animals, the Dimetrodon tends to ossify the muscle, ossify the certain muscle attachments in a certain order. And then once they're all ossified, the humerus and femur both get longer and the ends get wider, but the shaft tends to stay around the same width. So it's recovering that sequence as opposed to the rate.
Right. And Dr. Carr, maybe you can clarify this too. So is this work that nobody has done before, or is it work that has been done but not in quite the same way? I mean, in what way is this, in a sense, unique material being uncovered or unique insights?
Yeah, well, the basic approach was published back in 1996, and and theoretically and practically, it's a very illuminating avenue to recover growth. Usually, growth in fossil animals is size dependent, and we know that there's a lot of variation in size. So, for example, say if you've seen the old movie Twins with Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger, they're both adults, but their heights are vastly different.
Right.
And so size isn't a very good proxy for maturity, but we do have these hardwired sequences of changes. And the algorithms used to recover evolutionary trees are ordered and hierarchical series of changes lend themselves to growth, which is the same phenomenon. It's an ordered hierarchical series of change. So those algorithms are independent of the phenomenon, just, you know, all the basic requirements. We have a historical change from, you know, one thing to the next. That's the basic requirement. This thing has even been applied to the history of sorts. So even non-biological aspects that have hierarchy, you know, time hierarchy. So this is not widely applied, despite the fact that it can recover in very high resolution the sequences of changes in growth. And it cuts through the Gordian knot or the issue of size, because we're focusing on features that change through development, as Nathan just mentioned. And we can get more of a global view of everything that's happening when growth changes. And so I've published work on the growth of T-Rex, where I have data from the entire skeleton. And so we can really pin down the coordination of all the systems and features that change during growth in that animal. And that's something you simply cannot recover with any level of detail if all you're looking at is, say, size or just counting rings in a long bone. So it really provides a very in-depth and global view of how extinct animals grew up. And this can be applied to modern animals as well. It has been to Canada geese.
Wow. So in other words, you're helping us understand better that when you look at a given bone and it's this size versus that size, the size does not tell us very much about how mature this animal is. It is the shape and the features and the nature of those features that tells us more about its maturity. Is that?
Yeah, that was a very big – that's been traditionally a problem with a lot of Dimetrodon research in the early years, is that when they were first doing field work out in Oklahoma and Texas, They were always coming across. They were coming across, of course, the big Dimetrodon humeri, which are about, I don't know, size maybe a foot long, foot and a half. And they would always come across these little tiny humeri or femur or skeletons that were maybe, I would say, 3 inches long. But they would be so morphologically similar. So, of course, they name it as a new species of Dimetrodon, Dimetrodon natalis, which is approximately in life the size of a large house cat compared to the species that lived alongside it that was much larger, Dimetrodon lambatus, which is the size of a saltwater crocodile. So traditionally, it's been assumed that they've been different species. However, in the early 80s, Dr. Robert Bakker suggested that no, this isn't a distinct species. Dimetrodon natalis is just a little baby Dimetrodon lambatus, which isn't a bad hypothesis. I mean, these animals are very similar in their anatomy, size aside, or at least traditionally. Usually it's only the only differences are tooth count or the shape of the vertebral spines. You know, you have these very this very large sail on Dimetrodon that makes it so iconic. And so that's where a lot of the cladistic analysis start. The ontogeny investigation started was wondering, okay, are these different species or is it on one ontogenic line? And what was very interesting about my research was I was able to look at a lot of the Dimetrodon natalis remains that were featured in Bakker's research. And I kept finding that even when they're little, they were only like an inch or so, but these humeri would always have a fully ossified, or they'd have all the muscle attachments, and they'd fit perfectly in the ratio. So these are little adult Dimetrodons running around with an animal maybe 10 times the magnitude but very similar anatomy, and that was a shock. I was not fully expecting that. And that shows just how ontogeny really can inform the environmental structure of Texas and Oklahoma at the time, and how diverse our very earliest relatives really could get. I mean, that's a great deal of evolutionary plasticity in size alone.
Right, and that makes this whole field all the more exciting when you know that there's that kind of diversity out there waiting to be discovered and better understood. Very good. Again, Nathan Cochran again talking about his presentation made at this 82nd annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. Andy Wynn, who's a junior biology major at Carthage, and as Dr. Thomas Carr said a little earlier, your presentation sprang out of something a little bit different and some of the kind of real-life experience that you have had around this really troubling phenomenon of let's call it poaching of much of the fossil record. And specifically, your presentation is about the exploitation of the ivory from mammoths, which, of course, have been extinct for a very, very long time. First of all, explain to our listeners your own personal entry into this whole topic. What first kind of drew you to it and the work that you've done in it?
So with discussing research upon connection between the ivories of African elephants and the ivories of the extinct woolly mammoths, my role getting into that was spent almost 7 years combating global wildlife crime. So after almost a decade of service with U.S. Special Operations Forces, I started working for the United Nations Office on Drug and Crime. To this day, I still have ties to UNODC. And I was a wildlife crime investigator. I worked globally. I conducted anti-poaching operations. I trained wildlife rangers all over the world from marksmanship, combat trauma, casualty care, multi-purpose canine works. Canine dogs are a huge asset to combating wildlife crime. And eventually, when I got sick and tired of running into poach rhinos and poach elephants, I wanted to hit the bad guys where it hurt. I wanted to go follow the money. And so this led me to doing undercover work primarily in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam, Hong Kong, and China. And with this being said, with the undercover work, I started to get a huge idea of where these wildlife products, elephant ivory, rhino horn, tiger pelts, where it's being trafficked, who's trafficking them. Ultimately, for me, as the years went by, I started targeting organized crime from all over the world. So you have your Asian organized crime, your European organized crime, your Mexican drug cartels, domestic and international terrorist cells, you name it. Hmm. So if a bad guy exists, he or she will have their hands within wildlife crime. So wildlife crime statistics from the FBI, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and other international government entities place wildlife crime as the number one source of lucrative criminal income, fully surpassing human trafficking or sex trafficking, the trafficking of firearms, and the war on drugs. Now, the important thing for viewers to understand is that one source of income, in this case wildlife crime, it connects. It's a spider web. It's a global network, right? Mm. So wildlife crime helps fund and fuel terrorism. Terrorism helps fund and fuel sex trafficking. Sex trafficking helps fund and fuel fossil crime. Mm. These things connect. So I've had two personal experiences where I encountered fossil crime while dealing with wildlife crime. One of them was a raid in South Africa back in 2018, to where the shipping containers, as we are fully armed to the teeth, you know, we have plate carriers, short-barreled rifles. We have our multi-purpose canine dogs out. We bring the dogs to these shipping containers to practically detect contraband, whether it's wildlife crime, narcotics, even young teenage girls. And in this particular incident, after busting open one of these containers, I found a 3x4-foot wooden crate full of Permian-era fossils. Now, what the animals in this crate is actually what Nathan studies, because they could also be found in within the southern African continent.
These Dimetrodons.
Dimetrodons, much further resident. So they're after Dimetrodon, but before mammals.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, so I took a crowbar, busted open the top of the container, and immediately I knew these were animals. From my personal knowledge of dinosaurs and prehistoric life, I knew that these were animals found within this specific time period, because it's only located here in South Africa or within the southern African continent.
So in other words, you knew that these were not modern artifacts.
No,
these were from extinct animals.
They were completely destroyed. So all I needed to do was just reach over, and I started grabbing chunks of bone, vertebrae, pieces of skull, still with the rocks, the sediment attached to it. So that automatically told me someone here, whether it's in this country or, you know, locally, somebody knew these things were worth money, a lot of money. So most likely, as how with the global criminal network, there's a chain of command, right? You don't send your the main head honchos to go shoot the elephants, right? You go target the poverty-stricken people. These are the actual poachers,
right?
So it's the same thing for whether it's giving these poverty-stricken, desperate people. And, you know, at the end of the day, you have to feel for the situation, right? Because if you're a man in his mid-40s, it's the dry season, you can't catch fish, your wife is sick, your kids are dying from hunger, you're desperate, you want medicine for your wife, you want foods for your kids. Organized crime, whether it's corrupted politicians, whether it's corrupted wildlife enforcement or law enforcement, they're going to target you because they want you to do the dirty work for them. So in this case, most likely what happened was that these were poverty-stricken people in which, you know, this chain of command of organized crime went up to them and said, hey, you know, I'll give you some pickaxe. You see those really unique-looking rocks right there? I just want you to dig them all out. Just keep getting them out. So that destroys the fossils, right?
Right, because this is not a proper preparator or whoever properly trained to do this in a way that preserves the integrity of the fossils. So.
Yep, it's a hasty job. They just want to get these things out. You know, it's the same thing when they shoot an elephant or a rhino. They just quickly want to get the elephant or get the elephant ivory or rhino horn out. So that was my first experience actually witnessing fossil crime while dealing with wildlife crime. Now before that, I've dealt with the other sources of income. I dealt with human trafficking. I've done counter-cartel work. You know, I've done counter-narcotics. And I remember when I came home from this trip, I immediately contacted, you know, during that time, my soon-to-be advisor, Dr. Thomas Carr, you know, and I contacted him. And, you know, I remember contacting Dr. Thomas Holtz as well, Scott Williams, who works at the Museum of the Rockies and was actually a former law enforcement officer. Before it turned to paleontology, you know, and I remember mentioning to those three, hey guys, I just came back from South Africa. Guess what I just stumbled upon? So the second case is more drawn out, right? This is years working, undercover work in Southeast Asia, and actually finding openly in the public mammoth ivory. So let's take a step back. So why mammoth ivory, right? Ultimately, wildlife crime is based on basic economics, supply and demand. The lower the supply, the higher the demand. The global criminal network want the extinction of these modern animals, lions, tigers, crocodiles, elephants, rhinos, you name it. They want the extinction of these animals because their parts are going to be worth a fortune. I've had organized crime tell me directly in front of my face that they want elephants and rhinos to go bye-bye because the tusks and the horns will be worth more than gold. In fact, statistics from not only wildlife organizations, but global enforcement and intelligence organizations now place that rhino horn, for example, is worth more than cocaine and gold.
Wow. And because of the sheer scarcity, which by perpetrating their crimes, they're also making these animals more and more scarce and pushing them towards extinction, which drives the price up still more.
So with these fewer populations in Africa, African elephants, for example, you know, we're so desperate to protect these species that now for bad guys to get to them, you know, we all face our challenges, whether you're the good guy or the bad guy, in order to reach these animals. So with decreasing numbers of African elephants now, predicted to be extinct within the next 15, 20 years, you know, for viewers listening, if you have children age 15 or less, by the time they get to my age, 31, these animals will be completely eradicated from the wild. So why mammoth ivory? The bad guys are so desperate to fill in this demand, right, that they are now turning into these extinct prehistoric mammals from the Pleistocene, from the Pleistocene era of time, in order to harvest, you know, with obviously woolly mammoths, their mummified frozen bodies from Eurasia, dig out to not really dig out, but to actually completely destroy the side of a mountain in order to get the ivories out. And they're doing the same thing for these giant prehistoric species of rhino. They're doing the same thing for their horns in order to fulfill the demand for rhino horn. Everybody knows the saber cats, you know, the famous prehistoric large felines with those large canine-like teeth. Now they're excavating them as well.
You said your talk, I know, says that because of, we presume, climate change, the rising temperatures in the Arctic, that much of this material is also more easily extricated from the ground from the permafrost than was once the case, right? And we're talking about Russian organized crime going on in Siberia, going after these kind of specimens.
Russian organized crime will work with, you know, local lower gangs within the lower echelons of organized crime in order to extract these items from the ground. You know, so the methods they use, as I mentioned before, are very destructive to the environment. The entire fossils, right? These subfossils, they're completely destroyed because either they get destroyed in the process. For example, a high power hose or they're just left to erosion. So the bad guys will get the horn, will get the mammoth ivory out from the ground, and it'll just leave the rest of the remains to be exposed to the environment, you know. And let's talk about the high winds that happened there in Eurasia. These things are quickly gone.
Wow. So what was your main purpose in wanting to tell this story at this particular gathering? And what would you hope the good might be that would come from it?
As far as my understanding, when I was talking to this idea with Dr. Carr and also one of our alumni, my senior, Amelia Zietlow, who's now a PhD candidate in New York City at the American Museum of Natural History. You know, the three of us got together and we were like, why not? There hasn't been, to my understanding during that time, there hasn't been an open talk about fossil crime. Half the paleontologist community, you know, to them, the words fossil crime is just a myth. It's non-existent, you know. But for me, coming from my background, who witnessed fossil crime, you know, in all over the world, I my purpose is that I was the messenger. You know, I came from the front lines, and now I'm now here to report on what I've seen and done on the front lines. So the idea was welcomed at SVP. And the purpose of my talk was to not only bring awareness about these issues of how they relate to other sources of income, but the fact that fossil crime exists, it's quickly developing, it's left unchecked, unregulated. We need to be aware that fossil crime does exist. Fossil commercialization, the auctioning and sales of fossils, is the main driving force for fossil crime. Humanity has a great thing of pointing out a bloody rock at the ground, saying this is now valuable, and now people will lose their lives for it. You know, we see this with conflict diamonds, with rubber. You know, we see this in almost every single expendable natural resource or geological resource on the planet. Fossil crime is no different. Wildlife products are no different.
Dr. Carr, I imagine a talk like this shook things up a little bit at this event.
Well, it's certainly a riveting presentation, and the SVP has decided to put together a task force to look into the issue of mammoth ivory, and I guess an upshot of that will eventually be that the society will take a position on mammoth ivory. So it did catalyze a positive response from the society. It's now on people's radar.
Wow, that's got to make you feel really good.
For me, it was almost not just 6-7 years combating wildlife crime, all just crashing down, but also almost 15 years of dealing with conflict and conflict zones. The data I presented when I was doing this talk, people have lost their lives for this data. At the end of my talk, I had a memorial slide dedicated to two very globally well-known biologists and elephant ivory investigators. And, you know, they're not former special op guys. They're just scientists. They're just good men. And they've lost their lives. They were assassinated. They lost their lives when they decided to investigate elephant ivory. And I also dedicated a talk to three of my own personal fallen teammates who lost their lives combating wildlife crime. And just like me, these three individuals were former global special operation forces for their respective countries.
Wow. That's very sobering. It makes us all the more appreciative about the work that they've done and that you've done and that we all hope leads to a crackdown that can at least slow this, if not eradicate it altogether. I really appreciate you sharing that story. Dr. Carr, you made a presentation as well. We'll have to summarize it briefly, but it's really kind of interesting what you did. You and a team that you handpicked, in a sense, went tisk tisk to some other paleontologists who made kind of a careless classification of some T-Rex specimens. Explain to our listeners what this was about.
In a nutshell, earlier this year, a small group of scientists floated the idea that T-Rex ought to be split into three species. And that certainly was a headline grabber. But upon reading the actual article, it was obvious to me that there were some serious flaws with the analysis, and really the data didn't support their notion at all. So I wrote out the skeleton of a manuscript, and I invited a team on board who were specialists in different areas. And we published that rebuttal in July. And so it's the results of that work that I presented at the meeting as a talk, as a platform presentation.
So we all know, of course, Tyrannosaurus rex, so mm-hmm. king. But so these scientists were thinking we also need to have Tyrannosaurus regina, or mm-hmm. Tyrannosaurus queen, and Tyrannosaurus imperator, or emperor.
Yeah.
And much as that might sound poetic and kind of fun, in your view of you and your colleagues, the scientific record and geological evidence does not support doing that.
Right. There's no there, especially based on the anatomy and stats. It just doesn't hold up. Hmm. It was all shapes and clouds and shades of gray.
Hmm.
And it sort of lifted the lid on, you know, should we expect well-known dinosaurs to maybe harbor cryptic species?
Hmm.
And that is a reasonable thing to suspect, but you have to have evidence. And there was just nothing there to defend that position of splitting one species into three. And all the evidence points the other way.
Hmm. Very good. I have to say, as I was searching through this substantial booklet looking for the descriptions of what Nathan and Andy both presented, it was really interesting, even for someone as ignorant as I am, to get kind of a sense of the scope of study that this meeting represented. I noted in particular a number of presentations that had to do with 3D printing and the usage of that new technology. And mm-hmm. I remember my eyes drawn to someone who did a presentation on a new method for removing the skull from turtles that preserve the bone and the something else, the keratin. And so that would be, of course, for a preparator. But, I mean, even that field in and of itself, you have presentations with people doing new research, uncovering new knowledge and sharing it. Mm-hmm. I was surprised at how exciting it was to read through all this. Again, not understanding probably 9/10 of it, but coming away with a really interesting appreciation of how all of this happens and the importance of the work. So I'm so glad we had this conversation today to talk about all of this with Andy Nguyen, a junior biology major, Nathan Cochran, senior biology major, and, of course, their mentor at Carthage College, Dr. Thomas Carr. Gentlemen, this was really, really interesting. I'm so glad we had this conversation. Congratulations on gaining entry to the meeting, to be given the opportunity to make these presentations. And we hope that you have many more exciting such opportunities in your futures. And thanks again for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. Tomorrow on the morning show, a really interesting book called The Leak, which looks at an event largely forgotten that happened maybe a quarter a century ago at the Brookhaven Scientific Research Station, in which there was a discharge of sorts into the outer environment, and it caused a media uproar. I mean, not much at all in the way of actual significant damage to the environment, but there were politicians and members of the media who sort of pounced on this this incident, and some of the ham-handed ways in which the scientific facility handled this situation, and it ultimately led to Brookhaven being closed. And this new book that's just been published is called The Leak and explores this incident and also traces, in some respects, this incident to what we have seen as kind of an escalating public distrust of the scientific community. A very, very interesting story, which we will be exploring tomorrow on the morning show. Later in the week, we're going to be talking about upcoming events, including the Kenosha Symphony and Kenosha Pops Band and the newest production at the Racine Theater Guild. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org, and you can listen to the morning show as a podcast by looking for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Cloudy, breezy, seasonal today with a high of 43 degrees. Cloudy overnight with a low of 28. Tomorrow, much like today, cloudy and 42. Wednesday, cloudy, 43. Thursday, cloudy, 42. But we do have a chance of precipitation finally by Thursday and Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, NPR News.